These are the PCORI methodology standards. This category is about standards for adaptive and Bayesian trial designs. It was prepared by and will be presented by Dr. Gary Rossner, a biostatistician in the Department of Oncology.
Hello, this is Gary Rossner. In this module, I will be discussing ethical issues relating to adaptive trials. I'll have this discussion with Professor Nancy Cass of the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome, Nancy.
Thanks, Gary. It'll be really fun to have this conversation together.
I'd like to begin our discussion by talking about clinical equipoise and the ethics of randomization in general before we start talking about ethical issues that may be more specific to adaptive trials. So would you please tell me some views about clinical equipoise and randomization?
Sure. So maybe we should start by talking about what clinical equipoise is. There was a really terrific researcher and ethicist in Canada named Benji Friedman, who coined this term equipoise. And when he first coined it, he said that for a randomized trial to be ethically acceptable, the way he initially wrote it, he said the person doing the trial has to genuinely be uncertain and essentially feel uncertain about which of the two arms was better. There was pushback when he initially came up with this term, saying researchers often have a hypothesis, and it's good that researchers have a hypothesis. They've looked at pre-existing data, they've been practicing clinicians sometimes, and the fact that they have a hypothesis is a good thing. It helps them come up with ideas. And Benji Friedman recognized this, and the term was broadened to be clinical equipoise or sometimes community equipoise. And he refined his definition to say what there needs to be in place for a randomized trial to be ethically acceptable is the community of experts, the community of physicians, the community of people who analyze the data have to genuinely be uncertain about whether one arm is better than the other. Even though some individual physicians may think it's better to do X than to do Y, and others might think it's better to do Y than to do X. And even though in a given community, 75% of physicians may practice using only X and not Y, if there isn't clear data that show which arm is better, that counts. That's where Benji Friedman would give it a check mark and say there really is clinical equipoise and a trial ethically can proceed.
So assuming that the community does feel a sense of equipoise with respect to the treatments that are involved in the study, many of the studies are carried out with interim monitoring. A small group, a data safety monitoring board, will typically look at the accumulating information from the study, and there may already be statistical boundaries that have been put in place so that if there is evidence that one treatment is better than the other, or evidence that if the trial were to continue to the end, it would not provide convincing data that there is a difference between the two treatments. These boundaries are put in place to allow the trial to stop earlier than planned. Those types of trials, however, do not include modifying the randomization to favor one treatment over others if it appears as though that treatment is performing better. So let's talk about trends in a clinical trial. For example, halfway, three-quarters of the way through the trial, there may already be some evidence. The Data Safety Monitoring Board will see this information, whereas the participants, both participating caregivers as well as participating patients, will not be privy to this information. So at which point would you think clinical equipoise may be jeopardized by these accumulating trends?
Yeah, it's a really important question in this relationship between ethics and randomized trials. So as we were saying at the beginning of a trial, if there are not sound data that suggest that one arm is better than the other, it's okay to go forward with the trial, even if at the beginning of the trial, some patients might think they'd prefer treatment A or treatment B. As the trial goes on, as you just said, we get a lot more data. And by halfway through the trial or two-thirds of the way through the trial, there's now a fair amount of data that really start to suggest whether the two treatments are equivalent or whether one is better than the other. And yet, we often still don't have that statistical significance, the rigor on which we want to be able to ultimately say to the community of physicians, we know that this treatment is better than the other. We know that these two treatments are the same, use either one. The job of a trial is to be able to give some sound, rigorous guidance to patients and clinicians about which treatments work best. The problem is that partway through the trial, we start to have trends. As an individual, if I were able to look behind the magic curtain, look at the raw data that the Data Safety Monitoring Board is able to see, I might then choose, if I needed one of those treatments, the one where the trend was suggesting it's looking like it's getting better. And that does create this ethical tension that as an individual, I might want to be able to choose A over B if it was looking like it's better. But the truth is, it would be irresponsible to shut down a trial at that point and say, it looks like A might be better, so physicians from here on out should just give A to all their patients. We don't know that. And there's a reason why that rigor is required. We get into big trouble in our treatments and the harms that patients can experience if we don't put rigor and evidence behind our treatments. But at the same time, might there be ethical tension in what an individual patient or participant might feel when they'd love to know which one is looking like it's better? Of course they would.
So that introduces at least one of the arguments in favor of adaptive randomization within a randomized clinical trial. Namely, as the data accumulate and evidence also accumulates that one treatment may be better than the others that are being used in the trial, then the probability of a patient receiving the better performer increases rather than being, say, equal randomization. The probabilities change over time in favor of the better performing treatment. So some may argue that this mitigates to some extent this ethical tension that arises in a straight non-adaptive randomized clinical trial. What do you think about that argument?
So in the traditional trial, the introduction of the Data Safety Monitoring Board was what I might call one of the first big advances in recognizing the importance of this ethical tension. Saying to the community of patients and to caring physicians, don't worry, we're going to look at the data partway through. And if we already know with only half as many patients which one is better, we're going to stop the trial and give the better one to everybody. So that was what I will call step one in recognizing the need to balance this ethical tension in a way that is reasonable for both the well-being of patients and the well-being of our learning going forward. An adaptive trial to me is just a really important and enormous step two, in that, as you say, the ethical tension, in my view, is not exactly mitigated, but it's reduced. We reduce the size of it. So instead of a patient having, as you say, a 50-50 chance of getting drug A or drug B, when it's starting to look like drug A is better, maybe 60% get drug A or 70% get drug A. The comparison still has to be made because we still haven't reached that level of statistical significance, that level of rigor on which future patients and physicians depend for knowing the advice that they're being given medically is sound and reasonable. So the fact that a trial has to continue, as we were saying earlier, remains just as important. But to say, we get it, we all get it as humans, that drug A is looking better, we're now going to change the odds so that a larger proportion of you get drug A. We're still able to do a comparison, and we will do a comparison. But we're going to keep shifting the odds so that the one that seems to look better is the one that more people have a chance of getting.
So then the question arises, at which point is the evidence sufficient to stop the study and give the new treatment to everyone? 60-40 means it's 3-2 odds. Assuming that the randomization probabilities correspond to the current assessment of the probability that one treatment is better than the other. And when it gets to maybe 75-25, then it's 3-1 odods. It could be 90% probability. At which point should one consider stopping? And the other tension is that you mentioned statistical significance, which is a standard by which many traditional clinical trials are designed. That is, they're designed in a way that at the end of the study, they're going to evaluate what's the probability of seeing this much of a difference between the treatments, assuming that in fact there is no difference. So it's a proof by contradiction. In this case, with the adaptive trial, we're changing the randomization probabilities according to the evidence that one treatment is superior to the other. So now at the end, we're going to have a probability statement that one treatment is better than the other, as opposed to a proof by contradiction. It would be evidence in favor of recommending a certain treatment. So there's now a tension because in many situations, one designs an adaptive trial, keeping in mind that one has to satisfy regulatory considerations or the community's concern about falsely declaring superiority of a treatment, so that in fact you end up having randomization probabilities that are very high, let's say 90% on one treatment versus 10% on a control, yet it would not satisfy statistical significance. So how do we get around that? A famous example is the ECMO study, in which the first ECMO study, we discussed this in another module, in which the randomization probabilities followed a play the winner rule. And at the end of the study, they had treated 9 neonates with ECMO. All of them survived. They only treated one baby with the standard of care, and that baby died. This reached statistical significance, but the community felt that the evidence was not very strong. So there's a tension there, and I'm not quite sure how we can, or if we should resolve that tension. Another way of looking at it is, if an adaptive trial is in some way more ethical, adaptive randomization in the trial is somehow more ethical, then is it ethical not to have adaptive randomization?
Right. So you're the expert, I'm not, in how it is that we draw conclusions from adaptive trials versus traditional trials. There is clearly information to be gleaned from an adaptive trial. And smart people like you figure out what we can learn if it turns out that the data look a certain way or a different way under an adaptive condition, with the assumption that the trial perhaps started as a 50-50 randomization, and potentially nobody even considers adapting that randomization until some reasonable amount of data have accumulated. So there is always a question, even in a traditional trial, about what counts as knowledge, right? These are these epistemologic questions that emerge in any kind of research. We come up with these magical cutoffs as if they were honest-to-goodness truth. And what we're all saying, and of course, regulatory approval adapts similar kinds of conditions, we come to agreements that say this amount of truth is sufficient for making clinical recommendations, for making regulatory approvals, for making policy decisions. So a similar kind of thinking obviously would have to go into this. Smart people, thoughtful people, would have a responsibility to say, under an adaptive design, whether it were 60-40 or 75-25 or 90-10, ultimately, when do we have enough knowledge to be genuinely comfortable saying to a community of physicians, we now really believe that A is better than B, or we really believe it's not better than B? And again, that's your expertise, not mine, but it seems to me that that is an answerable question. If it turns out that more people need to be brought into the discussion to say some of the standards that you're used to, some of the raw numbers, the 0.05s, now get changed. There's a new set of standards we use, but trust us, they're also standards. Smart people have come up with them. Maybe that's a conversation that needs to happen. But I wouldn't want anyone to come away from this kind of discussion thinking that adaptive trials bring the pendulum to the other way, where we're simply looking at what patients might prefer and have thrown statistical rigor out the window. The goal, as I understand it, is to genuinely have a bit more balancing between those two commitments in a way that honors both to a much greater degree, rather than saying we're only honoring one of them for the length of the trial.
I think your point also brings up why it's so critically important when planning an adaptive trial that one review the trial's design, all the aspects of the design, with all key stakeholders, including patients, caregivers, maybe even regulators, but that everybody gets to see what are the decision rules, what criteria will be applied, how will they be applied in the design. And everybody gets to see through simulations under various scenarios how the design, the proposed design, will respond or react to accruing information and gets to voice their opinion, and that it represents a consensus among all these stakeholders.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, certainly so that from the regulatory side, people understand that there are clear, rigorous standards, but perhaps they're defined differently. From the patient side, transparency is particularly important in a randomized trial where, A, people don't know what they're getting. And so there is, I almost want to say, planned deception built in. And it's important to be able to say to people in advance, as we do through informed consent, there are certain pieces of information that neither you nor your doctor will be told, and here's why. And here's the small group of people who get that information, and here's the large group of people who don't, and at the end, people get it again, and here's why it's important to do it that way. That transparency builds respect into the conversation in a way that's very important in research. It also is important because empirically, when we do interviews with research participants time and time again, it turns out that people don't completely understand randomization the way we in the research world understand it. And patients continue to believe that somehow behind the scenes, their doctor has been able to select for them the treatment among the two options that really would be better for them, that somehow somebody's looking out for their individual interests and sneaks them the drug that's better, and which obviously is not how randomized trials work, whether it's the traditional design or adaptive. So transparency in all sorts of ways and more conversation in advance can only be a good thing.
Speaking of what you called planned deception in randomized trials, so in an adaptive trial, should patients be told what the current randomization probabilities are?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it seems that at very least, it's important to tell patients that they are in an adaptive trial rather than a traditional one. So at very least, it seems important to say to patients, we expect that this trial will go on for 3 years. At the beginning, until we accrue the first 200 patients, it will be 50-50. And then depending how things go, we're going to go to 60-40 and then 70-30 and then 80-20 if it turns out that our hypothesis is correct and one arm is better. So that's point one. I think it's important to let people know that. I guess my gut instinct is to say that it is appropriate to let people know what the randomization is. I mean, we certainly do that in a trial that's not adaptive but starts out with a non-50-50 randomization. And I don't really see any reason why we would do that differently. There's no scientific justification for doing it differently. I can imagine some people might feel anxious saying to patients, we're now at a 90-10 randomization, knowing that somehow that could make patients feel even more anxious somehow than a 50-50, that they're not getting the one that they believe is better. But we don't do anyone any favors ultimately by keeping that secret, I think.
Yeah, that's an interesting scenario to think about how patients would react if they saw that sort of imbalance in the randomization.
Right. I mean, it's both sides of the coin about what an adaptive trial is about, right? It is, on the one hand, communicating to patients, hey, we've really attended to your interests by ensuring that 90% of you get the thing that we believe is better, but we're still not quite sure. At the same time, it's also communicating, we've got a lot of information that makes us think that one of them is a lot better. And it's sensible that a patient might be more anxious to be in the 10% group than in the 50% group. We have a lot more information at that point. Mm-hmm. And the more information we have, the better the betting goes.
So adaptive randomization clearly doesn't solve all of the ethical tensions.
There's almost nothing that solves all the ethical tensions. I spend a fair amount of my time doing work on the ethics of different kinds of human research studies, and I feel like often our goal is to reduce what I keep calling this ethical tension. We almost never eliminate it. The same thing in informed consent work. We do a lot of work to try to improve how informed consent will go, to try to figure out new strategies that will increase the chance that people in studies understand what the studies are about. It's never 100%. It's never perfect. But if we can improve that, then presumably we've done a good job.
There clearly are many more ethics topics we could discuss relating to randomized clinical trials and adaptive trials. And I hope that this discussion has given you, the listener, a few things to think about and perhaps even raised more questions in your minds. But for now, I very much wish to thank Professor Cass for sharing her time and her expertise with us. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Gary. Nice to talk with you, as always.